Hi, I'm Spider Robinson, and you've found Spider on the Web. Eventually, this will settle down to a weekly podcast on the first four Fridays of each month. The first will consist of award-winning original science fiction stories, the second of timeless op-ed columns, the third of original music with an occasional celebrity guest star, and the fourth discussion of whatever has enraged or excited me that month. But to introduce myself, I'm going to spend my first 2 months bringing you two podcasts a week. Each week until mid-November, I'll read you a new sample chapter of my 33rd and latest book, Variable Star, which happens to be the one I'm proudest of, a posthumous collaboration with my mentor and friend, Robert A. Heinlein. These sample chapters are taken from Blackstone Audiobooks edition, with kind permission of Halo Williams, and you can find the text for them at spiderrobinson.com. Between these chapters, I'll read you one of the 8 essays on space and space travel that I wrote while writer-in-residence at Vancouver's famous H.R. Macmillan Space Center. Welcome, then, to another chapter of Variable Star, the first new Robert Heinlein novel in 20 years.
Two. Howe'er it be, it seems to me 'tis only noble to be good. Kind hearts are more than coronets, and simple faith than Norman blood. Alfred Lord Tennyson, Lady Clara Vere de Vere. The engine did not explode. It didn't even sound any louder than usual. The Mounties somehow failed to notice us blazing across their radar or to log any complaints about shattered windows. We crossed the province unmolested. For most of the trip, we were above atmosphere, so high that the horizon showed a distinct curve. We pretty much had to be at that speed, I think. But if the Peace Force's satellites noticed us, they kept it to themselves. 19 minutes later, the car finished decelerating, came to a dead stop, and went into hover mode, glowing softly from the heat of our passage and re-entry into atmosphere. "Wait," Ginny said, whether to Silver or to me, I was unsure. I glanced at her, then turned to my side window once again and looked down. Sure enough, what lay some 3,000 meters below us was a nearly featureless glacier. There was a big rill to the east, and a shadowy crevasse almost directly below that was much smaller, but still large enough to conceal several dozen cars the size of Silver. I looked back to Ginny. She was staring straight ahead at the windshield, which was still opaque. Keeping my mouth shut was easier this time. I not only didn't know how I felt, I didn't even know what I felt it about. I couldn't have been more clueless if I'd had my head in a sack. Anything I said was likely to sound stupid in retrospect, and there are few things I hate more. "I've rehearsed this 100 times, she said finally. "Now I've screwed it up completely." I suspected this was true, but kept my mouth shut. She swiveled my way and unbuckled her crash harness, though we were still 3 clicks above hard ice. It gave her enough freedom of movement to lean forward and take one of my hands in both of hers. I noted absently that the skin of her palm was remarkably hot. "Have you ever heard of Harun al-Rashid?" she asked me.
"Plays defense for the Tachyons?"
"Close," she said. "You're only off by, let me see, a little more than a millennium and a half, 1,500 and some years.
"But he does play defense."
"Stinky, please shut up. He was a rich kid from a powerful military family in ancient Persia. His father was a caliph, roughly equivalent to premier of a province today. A man so tough he invaded the Eastern Roman Empire, which was then ruled by the Empress Irene."
"You're making this up," I charged.
Her eyes flashed. "I said, please, Joel." I drew an invisible zipper across my lips. "Harun became caliph himself in the year 786, over 1,000 years before man could even travel anywhere. He was probably as wealthy and powerful as anybody in living memory had ever been, yet somehow he was not an ignorant idiot."
"Amazing," I said, trying to be helpful.
Go try to be helpful to a woman who's talking. "He had the odd idea it was important to know what his people were really thinking and feeling about things," she went on, as if I had not spoken. "He wanted more than just the sanitized, politically safe version they would give to him or to anyone he could send to talk to them. He understood that his wealth and power distorted just about everything in his relations with others, made it difficult, if not impossible, for truth to pass between them. You can see how that would be, right?"
"Sure, everybody lies to the boss."
"Yes!" Finally, I'd gotten one right. "Then one day he overheard one of his generals say that nobody knows a city as well as an enemy spy. It gave him an idea. That night he disguised himself as a beggar, sneaked out of his palace alone, and wandered the streets of Baghdad, a spy in his own capital.
Everywhere he went, he listened to conversations, and sometimes he asked innocent questions, and because he was thought a beggar, no one bothered to lie to him. He got drunk on it. He started to do it whenever he could sneak away. Her eyes were locked on mine now. It was important that I get this. Do you see, Joel? For the first time in his life, Harun got an accurate picture of what the common people honestly thought. More than just what they thought, he experienced firsthand what life was really like for them. Came to understand the things they didn't even think about because they simply assumed them. And their perspective informed and improved his own thinking from then on. He became one of the most beloved rulers in history. His name means Aaron the Just, and how many rulers do you suppose have ever been called that? One time, 15,000 men followed him into battle against 125,000 and whipped them, left 40,000 legionaries dead on the ground and the rest running for their lives. He lived to a ripe old age, and when he died, the whole Muslim world mourned, okay? I was nodding. I understood every word she said. I had no idea what she was driving at. She took a deep breath. Okay. Now, imagine you're a young Persian girl in Baghdad. I see your mouth opening, and so help me God if a wisecrack should come out of it. That's better. You're a poor but decent young Persian girl, working hard at some menial trade, struggling to better yourself, and so is... A strange alto voice suddenly spoke, seemingly from the empty space between Ginny and me, just a little too loudly. I was so startled I nearly jumped out of my seat. Your vehicle's hull temperature has dropped sufficiently to permit safety barking now, Miss Ginny. If I was startled, Ginny was furious. I could tell because her face became utterly smooth, and her voice became softer in pitch and tone, and slower in speed as she said, "There are only four letters in the word wait, Smithers. There seems little room for ambiguity." "I'm sorry, Miss Ginny," Smithers said at once, and although there was no noticeable cessation of any background hiss or power hum, somehow I knew he was gone. "And so," she went on before I could ask who Smithers was, "so is your boyfriend. Call him Jalal. The two of you are very much in love, and you want to get married, but you just don't have the means. And then one day—" "Wait," I said. "I think I see where this is going, sort of. One day, the beggar who lives next door comes over, right? And it turns out he's incredibly rich, and he says he's been eavesdropping, and he understands our problem, and he offers Jalal a—" I stopped talking. The penny had just dropped. All of a sudden, I actually did see where this was going, at least in general terms. "Oh, my God," I breathed. "I've got it just backward, don't I?" Her eyes told me I was right. "There wasn't any other way, do you see? Once I met you as Ginny Hamilton, I couldn't tell you, and anyway, the whole point was to—"
"You're Harun al-Rashid."
"Well, his granddaughter," she said miserably. I was stunned.
"You're rich."
She nodded sadly. "Very." Tumblers began to click into place. I tried to think it through.
"You're not even an orphan, are you?"
Headshake. "I couldn't let anyone at Fermi meet my parents. They're pretty well known. Hiring a pair of Potemkin parents for social purposes seemed grotesque."
"And you came to Fermi instead of Lawrence Campbell or one of the other top prep schools so you could, what, see how the other half lives?"
"Well, in part." I was ranging back through my memories, adding things up with the benefit of hindsight, understanding little things that had puzzled me. Silver's previously unsuspected power. Ginny's extraordinary confidence and poise, so unexpected in an orphan. How, whenever someone brought up one of the really fabulous vacation destinations, Tuva or the ice caves of Queen Maudland in the Antarctic or Harriman City on Luna, Ginny always seemed to have just seen a good documentary about it recently. The way when we ate pistachios, she always threw away the ones that were any trouble at all to open. I became aware that Ginny was absolutely still and silent, studying my face intently for clues to what I was thinking. It seemed like a good idea. Maybe I should get a mirror and try it. I thought about banging my head against the dashboard to reboot my brain. Instead, I looked at her and spread my hands.
"I'm going to need some time to process this," I admitted.
"Of course," she said at once. "Sleep on it. There's no hurry. Tomorrow I'll introduce you to my real father. And meantime, I'll answer any questions you have. No more evasions, no more white lies." I didn't feel as though I knew enough to formulate a coherent question yet. No, wait. I did have one. Purely for form's sake, I didn't see how the answer could help me. Still,
what is it really?
She blinked. "Crave pardon?
You said, once I met you as Ginny Hamilton, so that's not your real name. Okay, I'll bite. What is?
Oh, dear, she said.
Ginny O, Chinese dear?
Not amused.
Joel, come on, how bad could it be? Look, let's meet for the first time all over again. Hi there, I'm Joel Johnston of Ganymede, and you are?
She stared at me blank-faced. For so long, I actually began to wonder whether she was going to tell me. I couldn't recall ever seeing her hesitate about anything before, much less this long. One of the many things I liked about her was that she always knew what she wanted to be doing next. Finally, she closed her eyes, took in a long breath, released it, squared her shoulders and opened her eyes and looked me right in the eye. I'm very pleased to meet you, Mr. Johnston. I'm Ginny Conrad. For a second or two, nothing happened. Then my eyebrows and my pulse both rose sharply. It couldn't be.
Not
of Conrad, she confirmed.
It couldn't be.
It's true, she said. My father is Albert Conrad, Richard Conrad's third son.
You're Ginny Conrad of Conrad, I said.
She nodded once. I didn't quite faint, but it was good that I was sitting down and strapped in. My head drained like a sink. All the blood and most of the brain matter dropped at once to my feet.
Very rich, she'd said.
Yeah, and the Milky Way is rather roomy.
The Conrad Industrial / Informational Empire was larger than the Rothschild family, the Hanseatic League, Kinetic Sciences Interplanetary, and Rolls Daewoo combined, and only slightly smaller than the solar system. Nothing like it could have existed before the advent of space travel, and perhaps it became inevitable in the first minute of year one, as Leslie LaCroix was still shutting down the Pioneer's engine on the virgin surface of Luna. The Conrads were a 150-year dynasty, every member of whom wielded wealth, power, and influence comparable to that of the Hudson's Bay Company or Harriman Enterprises in their day. Their combined interests ranged from the scientific outpost on Mercury to Oort cloud harvest to interstellar exploration as far as 65 light-years away. At that time, there were well over a dozen starships either outgoing or incoming, and 8 had already returned safely out of a hoped-for 18, 5 of them bearing the riches of Croesus in one form or another. 3 of those big winners had been Conrad ships.
She gave me a minute. Well, some indeterminate period. Finally, she said,
"Look, I have to land now. Smithers wasn't completely out of line to remind me. We don't like to hover here. It's just a bit conspicuous."
"Okay," I said, to be saying something. "Where's here?"
"In a minute. Silver, I relieve you."
"Yes, Ginny."
She took the stick and we dropped 3,000 meters rapidly enough to give me heart palpitations, which nearly became cardiac arrest when the ground came rushing up and she failed to decelerate hard enough to stop in time. We were going to crash right through the imaginary glacier and into a deep valley, its floor lush and green and inviting and, best of all, still hundreds of meters below us. She landed us, without a bump, in a small clearing that from the air had looked indistinguishable from dozens of others, to me at least. But the moment she shut down, hoses and cables sprouted from the forest floor and began nurturing Silver. Ahead of us was a huge boulder the size of a truck. As I watched, a large doorway appeared in it, facing us.
"We're here," she said. "I ask again, where is here?"
She shook her head.
"It isn't." "Isn't what?"
"Isn't anywhere." I turned my head just enough to be looking at her out of the corner of my eye.
"Here isn't anywhere."
"Right." I closed my eyes. If I had just stayed back home on the farm, by now I might have been making enough of a crop to afford a hired man. That would have freed me up to do some courting. In a frontier society with considerably looser rules about premarital experimentation than contemporary Terra. But I knew for a fact there was no one remotely like Ginny anywhere on Ganymede. Had known it for a fact, that is, even before learning that she was more well off than the Secretary General. No, I couldn't take that in just yet.
"I really, really wish I could think of something more intelligent to say than, 'What do you mean, here isn't anywhere?'"
She shrugged.
"You tell me. If a place does not appear on any map anywhere, If it doesn't show in even the finest grain satellite photos, if no wires or roads or paths run to it, no government takes mail to it or taxes from it, and nobody is from there, in what sense does it exist? There is no here. Just us.
Here.
Exactly. I nodded and dismissed the matter.
And this is your home?
One of them.
I nodded. And your apartment on Luskeedy, of course. It must be weird having two homes.
She didn't say a word or move a muscle.
I turned to look at her.
More than two?
Silence. Stillness.
How many homes do you have, Ginny?
In a very small voice, she said,
8, not counting the Luskeedy place.
So?
But 3 of them are off-planet.
Well, naturally, I agreed, 1 winter's in space.
Oh, Joel, don't be that way.
Okay, let's go in.
She looked distressed.
If you are going to be that way, maybe it'd be better to do it out here before we go in.
I nodded again.
Mr. Agreeable.
Sure, that makes sense. Okay.
Then big.
How could you do this to me, Ginny?
She didn't flinch or cringe or duck.
Think it through, Joel. Sleep on it. Tomorrow morning you tell me. How could I have not done it?
I began an angry retort and swallowed it. I had to admit I had not begun to think this thing through yet, and Dad always drilled into me that the time to open your mouth came after that. Besides, I already had a glimmering of what she meant. I filled my lungs, emptied them slowly and fully, and said,
"You're right. Okay, I'm prepared to be polite now. Let's go inside."
"You won't have to be," she said. "I promise you won't see any family at all until tomorrow morning. I made them guarantee that. This is our prom night."
I frowned. I wish I had an overnight bag, change of socks, fresh shirt, my razor.
"Don't worry about it," she said, and unlocked the doors.
I let it go. Probably the contents of the slop chest here were finer than anything I owned.
"All right, invite me up to your place."
"Down, actually."
We opened our doors and got out. The roof of imaginary glacier did not exist from its underside. The moon and stars shone unimpeded overhead, a neat trick. But this was definitely not a natural ecology. The air was skin temperature, with an occasional breeze just slightly warmer. It smelled of dirt and green growing things, with just a little ozone tingle, as if it had rained recently, though it had not. The loamy earth beneath my feet was rich, almost quivering with life. Any farmer I knew back on Ganymede would have desperately envied it. Acres of it, at least a meter deep. Wild, uncultivated, supporting nothing but trees, scrub, and inedible berries. Just lying there. Conspicuous non-consumption.
"Start getting used to it, old son."
I thought of saying something, but I knew Ginny would never understand. It's funny. The very word Terra means dirt. And not one hungry terrestrial in 1,000 has a clue how important, how precious it is.
I shook my head.
The door in that huge rock ahead of the car was indeed an elevator. Back when I was 4, I'd been in an elevator that nice. In Stockholm, when Dad came Earthside to pick up the Nobel. Like that one, this elevator had a live human operator of advanced age and singular ugliness, who made it a point of pride to remain unaware of our existence. He happened to be leaving as we stepped in and took us down a good 50 meters with him. The car descended with unhurried elegance. It gave me time to think about the kind of people who would live deep underground in a place that did not exist and still feel the need to pull the sky over them like a blanket. Paranoid didn't seem to cover it. By happy chance, the operator decided to pause and check the operation of the doors just as he was passing the floor he wanted. So intent was his inspection, we were able to escape unnoticed. This left us in a kind of reception room, so lavish as to remind me of the lobby of that hotel back in Stockholm. The carpet was grass. But I didn't get time to study the room. Nearly at once I felt a tugging and turned to see a man older and uglier than the elevator operator trying to take my cloak. With some misgivings, I let him have it, and that seemed to have been a mistake, for he simply handed it off to a small boy who suddenly appeared in my peripheral vision and then literally threw himself at my feet and began loosening my shoes. I reacted. If we'd been under normal gravity on Ganymede or Mars, I think I'd have kicked his teeth in. As it was, he went sprawling. But he took a shoe with him as he went, a trick I admired as much as I resented it.
Ginny giggled.
I recovered, removed the other shoe myself with as much dignity as I could muster, and handed it to him as he approached again. He reunited it with its twin, bowed deeply, and backed away. I turned to Ginny and forgot whatever I'd been about to say. Her own cloak and shoes had been magicked away by tall elves, and she looked... How do girls do that, anyway? One minute just be there, and the next... be there. They can do it without moving a muscle, somehow.
"Good evening, Miss Ginny," said a baritone voice from across the room. "Welcome home."
Standing just inside a door I had failed to notice was a man nearly as tall as me with a shaved head, wearing a suit that cost more than my tuition at Fairmead Junior. Like us and the various elves I'd seen, he wore no shoes. Presumably they would cobble us all new ones in the night. "Thank you, Smithers. This is... damn, excuse me." She lifted her phone finger to her ear, listened for a few moments, frowned, said, "Yes," and broke the connection. "I've got to go for just a few minutes. Get Joel situated, would you please, Smithers? I'm sorry, Joel. I'll be back as soon as I can."
"Okay."
She was gone. Somehow he was at my side without having covered the intervening distance.
"Good evening, Mr. Johnston. I'm Alex Rennick, master of the house at present. Welcome to the North Keep. Let me show you to your room first, and then perhaps I can give you the 10-credit tour."
His eyes were gray, almost mauve. His head wasn't shaved. It was depilated. Despite his height, a dozen subconscious cues told me he was earthborn. He was fit and had an air of great competence and great confidence. I'm pretty good at guessing ages, given that everybody looks alike now, and I couldn't pin him down any closer than the 30 to 60 zone. I found it interesting that he knew my last name without having been given it. "Thank you, Mr. Rennick. You are most kind. Please call me Joel."
"And I am Alex. Will you come this way, Joel?"
I thought of an ancient joke, put it out of my mind, and followed him from the room. As I did, I promised myself solemnly that no matter what wonders I was shown here, I would not boggle. No matter how staggeringly opulent the place proved to be, I would not let it make me feel inferior. My father had been a Nobel laureate, and my mother a great composer. How many of these people could say as much?
"Do you have any questions to start?" he asked as we went.
"Yes, Alex," I said, memorizing the route we were taking. "Why does Jenny call you Smithers?"
"I have no idea."
His tone was absolutely neutral, but somehow I knew I'd touched a sore spot. Either it bothered him not to know, or the answer was humiliating.
"Ah," I said, lowering my pitch, "to drive you crazy, then."
I was curious to see how he would respond to an invitation to a jocular, between-us-men discussion of his mistress, whom I personally knew to be a handful and a half. He sidestepped effortlessly.
"That would be redundant, I'm afraid."
"Have you worked here long?"
"Yes."
"I see. How many people live here in the North Keep, you said?"
"The number varies."
His stinginess with information was beginning to mildly irritate me.
"No doubt, but surely as master of the house you know its current value."
I halfway expected him to say, "Yes, I do," and clam up, but he wasn't that kind of childish. Instead, he used jujitsu.
"There are 84 persons resident in the North Keep at the moment. By midnight, the number will be 92, and shortly before breakfast time tomorrow, it is expected to drop back to 89.
"Ah," I hesitated in phrasing my next question. "And how many of those are employees?"
"All but four, five tomorrow."
Yipes. Yes, Conrad's lived here all right.
"Here we are."
He stopped before a door that looked no different from any of several dozen we'd passed along the way, and tapped the button, which on Terra is for some reason always called a knob. The door dilated to reveal a room full of thick pink smoke. At least it looked like smoke and behaved like it, roiling and billowing, with the single exception that it declined to spill out of the open door into the corridor. I reminded myself that I'd promised myself not to boggle, and with only what I hoped was an imperceptible hesitation, I walked right into the pink smoke, came out the other side, and boggled. Worse, I actually yelped. I was on Ganymede. Look, I admit I'm a hick, but I had experienced sim walls by that point in my life, even if I couldn't afford them yet. Even good ones didn't really fool you. You could tell they were not real, just rectangular windows into worlds that you never really forgot were virtual. I'd even experienced six-wall sim, 360-degree surround, and even then you had to voluntarily cooperate with the illusion for it to work. It never quite got the rounding correction perfect at the corners.
but it was pretty good. This was real. I was back home on Ganymede, so convincingly that for just a startled moment, two-thirds of my weight seemed to leave me. I realized with astonishment that the air even smelled like Ganymede air, tasted like it, different from terrestrial air in ways subtle but unmistakable. I was standing in the middle of a newly made field, the soil only just coming to life. Beneath my feet, earthworms were shaking off the grogginess of cold sleep and beginning to realize they weren't on Terra anymore. On the edge of the field, 15 or 20 meters away, was a new-built farmhouse, smoke spiraling from its chimney. Try and build a fire anywhere else on Terra, and they'd fine you the equivalent of 2 months' tuition for a first offense. Until today, I hadn't seen a square meter of naked soil since I'd landed on its namesake. I felt my eyes begin to sting and water, and with no further warning, a tidal wave of homesickness broke over me. I spun around in time to see Rennick come through the doorway. From this side, too, it looked like it was full of pink smoke, but it was no longer a door in anything. It just stood by itself in the middle of the field, a rectangle of pink smoke without any wall to be a hole in. I turned my back on hole and housemaster alike.
"Miss Ginny thought you'd find this congenial," he said from just behind me.
I nodded.
"Follow me, please."
That didn't require an answer either. We walked to the farmhouse and went inside.
"The fresher and entertainment center are in the obvious places. You'll find clothing in that closet. Unlimited access at that desk. If you want anything, anything whatsoever, state your wishes to the house server. His name is Leo."
I had the homesickness under control now, enough that I trusted myself to speak, at least.
"Leo is listening at all times?"
"Leo listens at all times," he agreed, "but he cannot hear anything unless he is addressed. Your privacy and security as a guest are unconditionally guaranteed." "Of course," I said, as if I believed him. I idly opened the closet he'd indicated and found all my own clothing. Boggle. On closer inspection, it proved to be copies of nearly every piece of clothing I owned, all the ones Ginny had seen. They were not quite identical copies. For one thing, in nearly every case, the quality of the copy was slightly better than that of the original. Suddenly, I felt vastly tired. I didn't feel like boggling anymore, or struggling not to.
"Mr. Rennick, Alex, I thank you for your offer of a tour of the North Keep, but I believe I will pass, at least for tonight." "Certainly, Joel. If there's nothing further I can do for you now, I'll leave you to rest."
"I'm fine, thank you."
"Good night."
He left. I watched through a window as he walked across the field and through the pink smoke of the door without a wall. I looked around the farmhouse, then back out the window at a sky with two moons, and thought about bursting into tears, but I decided I was too manly. "Leo?"
"Yes, Mr. Johnston?"
"Can I get a cup of coffee?"
"On the desk, sir."
I blinked, looked. A steaming cup of coffee sat on the desk beside me. It hadn't been there a moment ago, but I hadn't noticed it arrive. Without a word, I picked it up and tried it. The superbness of the coffee was no surprise at all. The perfect drinking temperature was only a mild one. But the cream and two sugars.
"Did Ginny tell you how I like my coffee, Leo?"
"Miss Ginny has told me many things about you, Mr. Johnston."
"Call me Joel."
"Yes, Mr. Joel."
I opened my mouth, then closed it. There must be something sillier than arguing with software, but I can't think offhand what it would be. I sat down on a rocking chair that creaked authentically, put my feet up on a hassock, and began to dismiss Leo from my mind to prepare for the upcoming conversation with Ginny. Then a thought occurred. Carefully not addressing him by name, I asked, "How long do you keep listening after I stop speaking before you conclude I'm done and stop listening again?" Answer came there none, which answered me somewhere between 5 and 10 seconds. Useful datum.
"Leo?"
"Yes, Mr. Joel."
"Can you let me know just before Miss Ginny arrives here?" "No," she said from the doorway. "He can't." We were both tired and both emotionally upset, but we both knew there was more to be said before we could sleep. I took my feet down off the hassock, and she came and sat before me on it and took both my hands in hers. "No more ducking and weaving. Spell it out for me," I said. "In words of one sound bit, what's the deal?" She was through dodging. "I'm proposing marriage, Joel. Just as we've discussed, lifetime, exclusive, old-fashioned matrimony. And I'm offering to support us,
at least until you get your degree and start to become established as a composer and start earning. I can afford it. I'm quite sure you'll get that Calicanzaro scholarship. But if you don't, it won't matter. And best of all, we can start our first baby right away, tomorrow night if you want.
Huh? Skinny, what about your degree, your career?
My second career, you mean? It'll keep. I've always known what my first career has to be.
She tightened her grip on my hands and leaned slightly closer.
Stinky, maybe now you'll understand why I've been so...
She blushed suddenly.
So frimpin' stingy. So square, even for a Terran girl.
Why I don't park or pet or sneak out after curfew, and why our clinches never got out of hand, or were even into it, so to speak. I think you know I haven't wanted to be that way, but I had no choice. It may be all right for some other girls to bend the rules and take risks, but me, I've had it beaten into my head since I was 3 that I have responsibilities.
The family name.
The family name, my left foot. The family genes. Stinky, I'm a female human animal. My number one job is to get married and make babies, and because I'm who I am, a member of a powerful dynasty, it makes all the difference in the world what baby I have and who its father is.
She let go of my hands and sat up straight.
You're it. This is not a snap decision.
It began to dawn on me that I was not merely being offered acceptance into the fringes of the Conrad family. I was being asked to father its heirs. On Ganymede, I'd grown up seeing stud bulls brought in and put to work. They were always treated with great care and respect, very well fed, and certainly got all the healthy exercise a male animal could possibly want. Their DNA was vastly more successful than that of most other bulls, and their own lives vastly longer.
Nobody made jokes about them in their hearing.
But I couldn't recall one who would look very happy about the business.
Don't look so worried, Stinky. It's going to work out fine. You do want to marry me. We settled that, right?
I opened my mouth, realized I was harpooned, and closed it again. I had stated that only money prevented me from proposing. I didn't have a leg to stand on. Nevertheless, I found myself on my feet and being embraced. I had to admit, it was a very nice embrace, warm and close and fragrant.
Then it's all really very simple. All you need is a nice long chat with Grandpa Richard. You'll love him, really, and I know he'll love you.
I stiffened in her arms and fought with the impulse to faint.
Good old Grandpa Richard.
Known to the rest of the solar system as Conrad of Conrad, the patriarch, the chairman. I'd heard he had broken premieres. But perhaps the most awesome thing about his wealth was that, when I thought about it, I didn't actually know a single fact about him, save his name and exalted position. I'd never read an article about him, or viewed a bio, or even seen a picture of his face. For all I knew, he had taken my cloak when I arrived, Harun al-Hatchek.
She released me and stepped back. You'll see him first thing tomorrow. He'll explain things. And then afterward, you and I will have breakfast together and start to make some plans. Good night, Stinky.
We parted without a kiss. She didn't offer, and I didn't try.
I was starting to feel resentment at having been played for so long.
And also, I flatly did not believe there were no cameras on us. After she was gone, I thought about firing up that universal access Rennick/Smithers had mentioned and researching the size and scope of the Conrad Empire. But I knew if I did so here, now, on this computer system, Grantha Richard would know about it. It just smelled ripe to me. M'lady brings home a handsome hick, and the first thing he does is start pricing the furniture. The thought made my cheeks burn. Instead, I used that UA to Google around until I had figured out the Smithers gag. It turned out to be just as well Rennick didn't know the reference, if in fact he really didn't. Ginny was comparing him to an ancient cartoon character who was a cringing bootlicker, a toady, a completely repressed monosexual, and an unrequited lover. I wondered how much of that was accurate and how much libel. And just how far the analogy was meant to go. Smithers' employer in the cartoon, a Mr. Burns, was vastly rich, impossibly old, and in every imaginable way a monster. Did he represent Ginny's grandfather? Or father? Well, I would find out in the morning. Or maybe I would get lucky and be struck by a meteorite first. The bed turned out to be just like mine back at the dorm, except the mattress was better, the sheets were infinitely softer and lighter, and the pillow was gushier. Was I hallucinating? or did the pillowcase really smell faintly of Ginny's shampoo? It certainly did put a different perspective on things. It might be nice to smell that on my pillow every night from now on, and every morning, if in fact I was really smelling it now. While I was wondering, I fell asleep.
You've been listening to the science fiction novel Variable Star by Robert A. Heinlein and Spider Robinson, due out in Tor paperback at the end of November. These sample chapters are excerpted from the Blackstone audiobooks edition. To learn how this unprecedented novel came to exist, see its own afterword, or visit variablestarbook.com, where, among other things, you can see David Crosby and me on video together discussing Robert and our collaboration. The short answer is, I wanted to read a new Robert Heinlein novel so badly, I didn't care if I had to do all the typing. Thanks for listening. I welcome your comments and suggestions at spiderrobinson.com, and I hope you'll fall by next week for another Macmillan Space Center essay on space and space travel, and another audio chapter of Variable Star, all here free at Spider on the Web.